It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up in today's Wisconsin Life, we'll hear about a couple who started a second career after losing their jobs. They got into the ice cream business. First, the public worker landscape in Wisconsin was reshaped by Act 10, the politically contentious bill that took away most collective bargaining rights for public employee unions. Our next guest says the Wisconsin legislature should consider an idea from Germany to help include employees in workplace decisions. Ed Huck joins us now to tell us about the idea. He's the former executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance of Cities. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for calling.
Now, before we get into this idea from Germany, why do you think it's important to have some employee input on workplace decisions?
Well, currently we have a very bifurcated, or in some cases trifurcated, labor situation, especially for cities, where part of the union was rights were taken away under Act 10, while police and fire remain constant. So you have this very strange labor landscape that has evolved. And as I was a lobbyist for management for over 25 years, we always tried to alter the relationship in a manner where it was more balanced. We thought it was kind of leaning towards the unions. But the reality is, as we brought in ideas like lean government, where we needed to work with our employees in order to make government more efficient, Act 10 kind of flies in the face of that kind of partnership, where there is a scenario where employees and management work together to make things better. That was erased flat out with Act 10 by those who really don't want government to work well. So when I found this idea that has been around in Europe for more than 50 years, it seemed like a possible alternative to this very contentious landscape that we're currently living in.
So talk us through this idea, these staff councils or work councils.
Yeah, the staff council idea allows for certain rights under law that are similar to those of unions, but it's not a union situation. So the employees wouldn't have to belong to a union, yet they would have a voice in certain rights. And some of those examples of participation rights, which are advisory, would be staffing needs and training and how jobs would be filled. But then for disciplinary rules or breaks or hours or work environment, those would be mandatory discussion, would be a mandatory discussion between the councils and management.
How much power do the workers have to influence, you know, the conditions under which they work in a situation like this kind of work council?
Well, the idea behind the work council is for the betterment not only of the workforce but the institution. So the discussions are not about them and us, which is the current labor union relationship. It's about how can we make the institution a better place for the customer. And the customer is the taxpayer. So you have a scenario set up where how can we become efficient to serve the people that we need to serve in the most efficient manner in order for the taxpayers to get the best bang for their dollars. So it creates this cooperative scenario, and it would take time for trust to build between the employees and management, especially after what we just went through.
Talking to Ed Huck, former executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance of Cities. He says in the public employee aftermath of Act 10, the state should consider a model based maybe on Germany, staff councils, where workers get some kind of participation in decision-making at their workplace. I want to throw objections to this at you, maybe from both sides here. Ed, first of all, from somebody on the labor side, they might say, well, this is really weak tea compared to a labor union that's advocating for the workers and their rights and their compensation, things like this. This is a poor second to that. How would you respond to that?
Well, one of the things that they allow in Germany is for minority unions. So instead of taking a scenario where you have to have 50%+ in order to certify the union, you could have minority unions. So that actually could allow for unionization where it currently doesn't exist. So that's one argument. But the fact of the matter is that across the nation, union representation has dropped below 15%. And the idea that that there shouldn't be employee representation without a union is passé. It's gone. It's old history. And so if we're going to look to the future in a way where we can still bring in the minds of the employees to work with management to make things better, we should do it. Because the fact of the matter is when a huge sector of the workforce is left out of decision-making, we are actually shrinking the intelligence of the institution by a significant number. And that's what I'm afraid of. When you have you in control and they think they're doing the best for the whole group, it's not a given by any stretch of the imagination. So when we open up to the discussion to a lot of good minds, good things happen.
Objection maybe from the other end of the spectrum. People might look at this and say, hey, I don't have this kind of representation in my job in the private sector. I do, you know, my boss sets the conditions under which I work. So this is giving too much to public sector workers, to public employees. Why do they deserve that? Why do they get that when a lot of people don't?
Productivity. The thing that everybody wants as an employer or as an institution is that productivity increases per worker. And there are decades of study that clearly show a discontented worker does not produce the same as one that feels safe and feels that they are receiving a wage in line with the output that they're putting into their job. So it's a matter of how can we make government better? Not the current philosophy by some on the far right side want government to fail because they wanted to privatize it.
Meetings of the Wisconsin.
And the fact is that we don't want that, that most people do not want that to happen. They want their government to work efficiently and effectively at the least amount of cost to the taxpayer.
Now you floated this in an opinion piece, Ed. What kind of response have you gotten? Are you hearing from people who like this idea for Wisconsin?
I think I've heard from both sides just pretty much as you laid it out. There is skepticism from the labor side, and there's skepticism from the management side that this may not work. But until I suggested that they have a legislative council work through the details with management and labor sitting at the same table, and otherwise there's going to be pressure to go back to the way things were. And I am not a firm believer in the way things were, but I'm not. I'm very cynical about the way things are in terms of making government work.
Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for asking.
That's Ed Huck, former executive director of the Wisconsin Alliance of Cities. He wrote an opinion piece presenting an alternative to Act 10. You can see it, by the way, and comment on it if you'd like over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Summer is winding down in Wisconsin, and many people are making their final pilgrimages to lake homes and cabins up north. But one couple has found a way to enjoy balmy summer weather all year round.
Hi there.
Hello.
Inside the boxy white walls of her ice cream truck, Diane Steflug takes orders through the window.
Large buffalo raspberry.
While her husband John scoops mint chocolate chip and black raspberry into cups and cones. They're such a well-oiled machine, they might as well have been serving frozen treats all their lives. But actually, the Steflugs didn't become business owners until they were well into their 50s.
Our income changed drastically. Our foundation that we had been building was now gone.
It started 8 years ago. When the recession hit in late 2007, John lost his job working in IT. He couldn't find work. Nobody wanted to hire an employee so close to retirement. So like a lot of much younger folks who are choosing lifestyle perks over profit margin, the couple decided they might as well gamble on a new career that promised a more relaxed atmosphere.
And we said, oh, now we can have fun and be working.
I was only 58 at the time, so I couldn't retire yet. But, you know, you can't find a new job at that age either. We need to do something, you know. We didn't want to sit around and do nothing, so we started this.
They bought an ice cream business and moved from Milwaukee to St. Germain in rural northern Wisconsin, where they had a second home. Beautiful summer weather and a slower pace of life sounded pretty good to the pair of city dwellers. And when winter set in all too soon, the Steflugs decided to take their freezer and head south to their other favorite vacation spot, Naples, Florida.
It was such a big hit that we just kept going back, and we now spend 6 months in Wisconsin and 6 months in Florida selling the ice cream.
Now they're earning a living and enjoying year-round sunshine. They haven't shoveled snow in over 7 years.
The longer you're away from the Wisconsin winter, the more you appreciate not being in the winter months in Wisconsin. We've become wimps.
But it isn't all sunshine and sweet treats. Scooping thousands of cones each weekend takes its toll. And a traditional retirement lifestyle is looking better and better.
I'm starting to have more and more aches and pains. We do a couple music festivals where it starts at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon and you're there till 1 o'clock in the morning. It's starting to get a little bit rough. We're not bouncing back as fast as we used to.
Would you go back to your old life if you could?
I don't think so. It's too much stress. Yeah, there's a lot more stress in that life than this life, you know.
You know, there's many days where our outfit for the day is flip-flops, a T-shirt, and a pair of shorts. It would be probably harder to go from this back than it was from that to this.
When it does come time to retire, they'll be able to split their time between vacation spots without thinking about the bottom line.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. Well, for a lot of adults, life-changing circumstances can call for the need to find a second career, maybe get an education to do that. But for others, that education is just a part of their lifelong learning. Jeffrey Russell joins us now with some advice and resources for people looking to go back to school for whatever reason. He's Vice Provost for Lifelong Learning and Dean of Continuing Studies at UW-Madison. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate you having us on the show.
Well, a lot of people, if we think about college students this time of year, we're thinking of those new high school graduates entering their freshman year. Tell us about the other students, though, the people you see in your program. Who are they?
Well, we're really excited to be a place where every person in the state and beyond can connect to the university. So this isn't a residential piece, as you were referring to, in terms of all the new students mm-hmm. moving in. But the chance for all of the listeners to identify with UW-Madison as a lifelong learner, and as you indicated, it goes all the way from personal enrichment to perhaps needing to acquire some new workplace skills in a changing economy.
And what kind of services and programs can people in that situation find with continuing studies there?
Well, we've got a number of things. One is that we've got an adult and career service office that can help people think about perhaps making a transition in their career, think about some additional skills that they might want to pick up, perhaps they want to complete their degree. In other cases, it's much more around the personal enrichment side where folks are really interested in engaging, whether it's arts, creative writing, perhaps it's a foreign language, and it's really about the quality of life and the ability to continue to develop themselves around some of those areas of interest.
Let's start with that first group you mentioned, people looking for that either a new career or maybe doing things to certify them to move up in their current career. How common is that among the people who come to you for resources?
Well, I think as you're probably reading, like a lot of the listeners, I mean, the economy is got a lot of different issues in terms of the continued development of skills if you're between transitions or perhaps there's new technology that's being introduced. So we've got a number of things from credit-based certificates to more accessible master's degree programs to non-credit programs that might help build skills in a given area that would help somebody choose a new career or perhaps enhance their skills in their current career.
And you mentioned accessibility. A lot of people in this position aren't going to be able to, you know, move into the dorm like the freshmen and stop everything and start this new program. How are these programs built around people's work lives, parenting lives, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that's the really exciting thing that we're working on, recognizing that it's flexibility and access are two important pieces that particularly the adult learner is confronted with. And so what we're really trying to do is to figure out ways in evenings and weekends and where it makes sense in an online format to make it flexible and yet accessible for these high-quality learning experiences.
So for someone wanting to do this with employment in mind, what sort of questions should they be asking themselves to figure out what kind of educational program would be right for them?
Well, I think that if they would come in and sit down with some of our counselors here, the first couple of questions are going to really deal with their interests and passions and where do they see themselves and what kind of things are they really motivated by. And then it's a matter of figuring out what's the appropriate educational experiences that are going to make sense for them, and then figuring out then how to find that. And that might not always be available here at UW-Madison, but it's important to try to connect them with the appropriate educational resources that are going to help them advance in their learning and advance in their career planning.
Talking to Jeffrey Russell, he's Vice Provost for Lifelong Learning and Dean of Continuing Studies at UW-Madison, about going back to school, getting some kind of education, even if you're not that new freshman at a UW system school, say. Now let's go to the other side we started with, Jeffrey, the lifelong learners. Who are we talking about there?
Well, the beauty is that's all of us, and hopefully everybody that's listening can identify with that. And whether we're in formal schooling or not, I think we're all on a journey to continue to build our knowledge and skills in a variety of areas.
And what kind of programs do you see people coming back to learn, even if they're not related to their work life?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of interest in the humanities, the whole notion of the human expression, whether it's art, whether it's creative writing, whether it's the languages that they want to learn, whether it's art, dancing, art, a whole variety of areas like that that we see a number of folks interested in, as well as the workplace skills.
And we now have this internet thing. How much of an online presence does a program like yours have?
Well, it's clearly growing. I think that's the real exciting work that we're undertaking now, is that we've got to increase access, and we can't allow people totally to be place-bound. And with the ability to have some virtual communities, we can really increase inclusion and the diversity and the number of options that are available. So we see this growing over time. Our non-credit courses would probably be about 15% are online, and we're offering over 50 different accessible post-bachelor's programs. In a large share of those, a large number are online.
And I understand you have a new program, a Living Well Today and Tomorrow. Tell us about that and its launch this fall.
Well, we're trying to really look at this basic notion of quality of life, and it means many, many different things, emotionally, being involved in other ways to express interest and meaning. And so we're really excited to get this started and explore how this can help make a difference in people's lives.
Now, can you make the case for us that we should all be lifelong learners and think of ourselves and act like lifelong learners?
Well, I think that, when you step away from traditional learning and the assessment piece of it, these are things that are driven by your interest and passion. And I think that that puts a little bit different perspective on it, where people are really trying to acquire things because of their own curiosity and interest. So I think it's really important that we shape the learning that recognizes people have different life experiences, and they bring that to the learning, and they learn from each other. And I think that's what just really makes community important, whether it's here locally on campus or at another location, because we do learn in community, and we are connected to one another. There's just tremendous opportunities for all of us to grow and develop.
Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, well, have a good day.
You too. That was Jeffrey Russell. He's the Vice Provost for Lifelong Learning and Dean of Continuing Studies at UW-Madison. We've been talking about lifelong learning, whether for a second career or personal enrichment. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up, Wisconsin lakes will be a testing ground this coming year to see how organisms respond to climate change and pollution. We'll talk to a biologist recently awarded a National Science Foundation grant for that research. First, immigration has been one of the most hotly debated issues of the 2016 Republican primary race so far. Since Donald Trump joined the PAC in June, candidates have sparred over who should enter the country and what to do with unauthorized immigrants already here. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, immigrants make up 17% of the workforce. One of the biggest questions in the debate is how new people entering the country affect the workforce and overall economy. Do immigrants increase unemployment and suppress wages? Do they create jobs and help bridge a skills gap? On Labor Day, we want to try to untangle some of those biggest economic questions about immigration. Stephen Deller joins us to help do that. He's professor of applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleased to be here.
So, big picture, how much of the country's GDP, how much of our economic output is produced by immigrants?
I think it's probably less than the 17%. And I think that's because a lot of the immigrants are actually working in lower skill type jobs. And as a result, they're not contributing to the gross domestic product or the overall economy to the same extent as others.
Now, you mentioned those lower-wage, low-skilled workers. A lot of times it seems like there are two separate conversations about immigrants in the labor force, those low-end ones and then the high-skilled jobs that some on both parties are trying to attract to the country. Let's talk about those high-skilled workers first. How do they affect our economy?
Well, let me confuse it even a little bit more. I think there's three types of immigrants that are coming in. One is what's called H-1 visa immigrants. These are the folks that have PhDs, advanced degrees, they're engineers, they're biochemists, they're ones that are working for Google and Microsoft and some of the the research labs. And those are the folks that are actually kind of contributing to kind of the technological edge that the U.S. has. I mean, they're an important piece of U.S. innovation, and I think they're extremely important to have here. The second is kind of the laborers that you mentioned. This is where a lot of the illegal immigrants are kind of working in. These are your dishwashers and fry cooks and things like that, and agricultural workers. Those are the ones that are really working the lower paid jobs. They're basically working jobs that your typical American doesn't want. The third, the complicated, is really kind of the entrepreneurial immigrant. When you look at a lot of lower income inner city areas and a lot of rural communities, you look at a lot of the small businesses that are starting up, they're being started up by immigrants. And these folks are bringing very much of an entrepreneurial spirit into the communities that they're locating in. Now, a lot of these may not grow up to be the next Google or Microsoft, but they are an important part of the U.S. economy.
Well, let's start again with that that lower wage group. Often, as you say, the unauthorized immigrants here. One of the frequent arguments for a tougher immigration control is that they work for low wages, and therefore they either drive wages down for other low-wage workers or they crowd them out of jobs. How much do we know about that actual impact?
A lot of it is case study-based because there really isn't a whole lot of really good secondary data to kind of do more what we call ecological studies, which is kind of comparing, you know, let's use Wisconsin counties and see what's happening from a statistical perspective. What's happening is that there is a labor shortage at this low end. When you're talking minimum wage jobs, minimum wage with no benefits and not necessarily pleasant jobs, Americans won't take those jobs, period. We won't. So there's a labor shortage. And what these immigrant workers are doing is actually filling a gap in the labor market. My work with a lot of rural communities, you have a lot of dairy farmers in Wisconsin that are very concerned about some of these immigration reforms because they realize that, you know, there are farmers out there that are saying, I'm willing to pay $15 an hour. I still can't get workers. And the Latino workers are actually, for $15 an hour, they're excellent workers. So take these dairy farmers, for example, and they say, I'm offering $15 an hour. I can't offer more than that. It doesn't make business sense for me. And I can't get local people to take those jobs. So what do I do? Well, I try to partner with those immigrant labor supply.
So from a market perspective, maybe if that supply of labor willing to work at that wage wasn't present, if there was some kind of crackdown, they weren't there, would wages eventually nudge up to the point where American workers would take those jobs?
No, because I think that a lot of the businesses that we're talking about simply cannot. They don't have the profit margin in order to pay those higher wages. One of the things within agriculture is that we've had a policy, a U.S. policy of cheap food. And the way that that's played out is that the margins or the profit levels within agriculture are very, very thin, which means that you cannot afford to pay higher wages within these industries. You simply cannot afford to do it. You'll go out of work. So even if you took that supply of labor away, right, and you said, okay, well, what you're going to do is you're going to have to force wages up. What you're going to do is you're going to drive a lot of these businesses under. It's the same type of thing that when we're talking about raising the minimum wage up to $15 an hour, those same businesses that are that would be negatively affected by that would be negatively affected by reducing the immigration flow.
Talking to economist Stephen Deller from UW-Madison about immigration in the United States and the impact it has on workers and the economy. Now, an argument I've seen kind of from the other side, from pro-reform, pro-legalization advocates, is you've got unauthorized workers, and you've got some people here on work visas that say you can only work with this one particular company. That, they say, creates a workforce that has no options, no ability to bargain with employers. If they don't like their working conditions or their wages, their choices are leave, risk legal problems, or just stick with it. So they say by having more legal workers, that would give them more bargaining options, drive wages up for themselves and maybe everybody else. Is there anything to that?
Are there unscrupulous employers that are taking advantage of this labor supply? Yeah, there are. And is that a problem that we should be dealing with? Yeah, I think we should be. But I think that, you know, these are shades of gray in terms of complexity of the issue. And unfortunately, with a lot of the policy discussion right now, it's talked about in terms of black and white. Either open up the gates and let everybody in, or put a wall up. Put a wall up against Canada. And it's you know, it's kind of silly season in a lot of these political discussions around this.
The Economic Policy Institute, a group generally on the left, recommended maybe making immigration numbers more responsive to the current state of economy. So instead of the same guidelines from year to year, say, if the economy is booming, we need more labor. Let's let more legal immigrants in. Things are slowing down. There's more unemployment. Slow it down. Or even job specific. Hey, if there's high unemployment in construction trades, don't give work visas to construction workers coming in at a high level. Can we have a more nuanced approach that meets the needs, the year-to-year needs of our economy?
If Washington was functional, I'd say yes. The question is that how would you implement a policy like that in this current political environment? The question is whether or not we can develop a policy that we can fine-tune and that is nimble and flexible. And I'm not sure that we could do that right now. So I think what we need is a set of policies that are reasonable and that eliminate a lot of the uncertainty and risk that's associated with immigration right now.
Well, reasonable, I think, is in the eye of the beholder in many ways. Can you spell out at least the contours of what a reasonable reform might look like?
I think a reasonable reform is, well, you have to look at the immigrants and why they want to come to the U.S. Many of them are economic immigrants. They're coming here simply because they want to try to provide a better living for their families. And those immigrants are different than immigrants that are coming to the U.S. because of political conflict. Europe right now is struggling very much with the flood of refugees coming from the Syrian war in that part of the country or that part of the world. And then we have the high end. I mean, the immigrants that have the PhDs that are coming and wanting these high tech jobs. Can we have one blanket policy that covers all of those? I don't think we can. It's too subtle for that. Now, if we want to take it apart and say for these high wage potential immigrants, high education, high skills, let's have one set of rules for them and then another set of rules for asylum seekers and a third set of rules for more kind of just pure economic immigrants, I think that we could actually come up with something a little bit more reasonable.
It's Labor Day. We're talking to Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison, about how immigration affects the U.S. workforce and economy. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience with how immigration affects the workforce and the economy? Are you an immigrant yourself? What's your work story? Are you an employer who maybe has employed immigrant workers at some point in your career? And what do you think the country should change, if anything, when it comes to immigration laws? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Labor Day. We're continuing our conversation with Stephen Deller. He's a professor of applied economics at UW-Madison, talking about how immigration affects the U.S. workforce and economy. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you think the country should craft its immigration policy to best benefit the workforce and the economy? Are you an immigrant? Do you employ immigrants? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a call. We've got Heidi on the line in Campbellsport. Heidi, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what do you want to bring up, Heidi?
Well, I have no issues with immigrants and having them be a part of the workforce. Where I would have more issues is how they're affecting the rest of the economy and things such as, are they paying taxes the same as the citizens are? Are they paying for education the same as the citizens are, and health insurance and all of those things? Or are a lot of those things being funded through the citizens' taxpayer dollar? You know, like I have to pay and co-sign and everything else for my kids to be able to go on to college. But I know there's times where the immigrants are going to school and learning English for free and...
Thanks a lot for bringing that issue up. That's something I wanted to get into too. Steve, do we know, this is a common argument, how much do immigrants, especially unauthorized immigrants, pay into Social Security, the taxation system, versus services that they, maybe their families might receive?
Well, first of all, there's really three types of taxes that we pay in general. The big three are sales tax, property taxes, and income taxes. Immigrants, whether they're legal or undocumented immigrants, they're paying property taxes and sales taxes. Every time they go to the store and buy something, they're paying taxes. Whenever they pay their rent to their landlord, the landlord is taking some of that money and paying their property taxes. The question is the income tax and Social Security tax. And that is really a function of how the employer has set them up. Is the employer treating the immigrant worker as a paid employee and is withholding property tax or withholding income taxes and making Social Security payments? Or is the employer treating these immigrants as, say, contract workers, where they're simply paying them cash under the table? That cash under the table is not strictly illegal, but it's kind of getting into that gray zone. So I'm not sure it's really the immigrants that are it's how their employers are setting up the relationship here. Now, in terms of whether or not they're paying their fair share, you know, when you get into a lot of these, you know, what is the cost? What are the public service costs? And one way is, and a lot of this is talked about in terms of public schools. It really depends on the public school system itself. A lot of public school systems are operating at, say, 70% capacity, and adding a handful of immigrant children really costs hardly anything. If the school is crowded and you start adding more immigrants, guess what? That's going to cost a lot more. Now, a lot of rural communities are suffering with this English as a second language problem, particularly when you see a lot of large food processing plants that bring in a lot of immigrants. That's a cost. But I think that most of these rural communities are actually kind of embracing these immigrants coming in because it's a breath of fresh air into these communities. You're starting to see businesses pop up in these downtown areas that are related to the immigrant population. So while there's a shaky transition to begin with, I think most communities are welcoming them with open arms.
Heidi, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Alan in Appleton. Alan, hi.
Hi, thank you. I've installed equipment in a number of manufacturing facilities in Milwaukee in the recent years and all over the country. And like the one place that I worked at in Milwaukee that was union, which was Wacker, which is right next to Harley-Davidson, great place to work in, very clean. There were two other facilities, at least I worked in Milwaukee, that were coding facilities. 75%, I'm going to say roughly, of the people there that worked there were Hispanic. In a majority, you know, black or white town, and I'm pretty sure that most of them didn't speak English that I tried to interact with. And so I don't know, and I'm a pretty liberal person, and I'm pro-immigration, but I don't think people realize actually what is going on there. These, and the places I worked at were dirty, they were dangerous. I couldn't breathe in the one. Like, we were installing some equipment, we were working just a little ways away from some guys that actually worked in the plant full-time. I mean, the chemicals that they were using were bad. This stuff happens all over the place. These places are nasty, and they have no protections, and that's why they hire people that don't have rights.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. So he says these workers Hispanic. He thinks mostly immigrants, maybe some authorized, subject to unsafe working conditions in these manufacturing facilities. I don't know if there's much research in this area, Stephen.
This goes back to the comments early on in the session, where manufacturing is really kind of composed of two different types of jobs. One is kind of high skilled engineering, need to be comfortable working with computers and high end. The other is kind of the low end remedial type labor, and those remedial type labor jobs, most of them, they don't pay very much, not necessarily pleasant working conditions, and most Americans won't take those jobs. You go into the food processing plants, particularly some of the poultry plants and beef plants, the slaughterhouses. You go into those in Iowa, and it's all Latino workers. Why? Because we can't afford to pay what most Americans would require to work in those kind of conditions. They're very unpleasant conditions, and these Latino workers are more than pleased to take them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking with Stephen Deller, economist at UW-Madison, about immigration, and how it affects the U.S. labor force and the economy. Back to our callers now with Bob on the line in Madison. Bob, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This question maybe is more out of curiosity than anything. I travel to Mexico with my business, and I hear very often down there, not so much recently, but in the past few years, that the income in Mexico has increased tremendously by the dollars leaving our country and going to Mexico from the immigrants and laborers here that are sending money home to families, to the point that it's now second or third as far as the national income for Mexico. And I wondered, truth in that, if there's that much money leaving this country, nobody ever speaks to that.
Bob, thanks for the call. Steve?
Actually, there is a fair amount of remittance going back into these countries. We did a study, it's about 10 years ago now, so it's getting a little dated. And these were migrant farm workers. These were the kind of farm workers that would, you know, move from farm to farm to farm. And what we found is that the amount of money going back to their home country depended upon whether or not it was a family that was moving from site to site, or whether or not it was a single male. A single male, you're right, the vast majority, about three-quarters of the money was going back to their home, their family. But if it was a family that was moving, about three-quarters of that money stayed here. Now, some of the stuff that's going back is they're actually buying things here in the U.S., that you cannot really buy in a lot of these developing countries in Central America, and they're shipping them back. So you may buy maybe an iPhone is a bad example, but you would buy something like that here, and you'd ship it home. So where are the taxes being paid? The taxes are being paid here.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Bruce with us in Toma. Bruce, hi.
Hi. I'm an accountant, and I've worked for manufacturers in the metal industry, plastic industries, for the past 30 years. And I've done the budget, so I know what everybody is making in the factories that I've worked at. And the wages, I won't go into details, but I can remember a person's wages being $10 an hour in a small town like Eau Claire, size city, 1988-89. And the same type of job right now in Chicago, oh, it pays $14.75, $15 an hour, something like that. Benefits about the same in both situations. I realize the employer's paying more percentage for health care benefits than they did in 88, but I'm just saying is that a lot of these jobs that are stepping stones for better ones are being held, the wages are being held down by immigration. And another thing, too, is that when you work in these factories, they want a lead person in the factory floor. Oh, they want somebody who speaks Spanish preferred. Well, that eliminates, and I've seen it, eliminates a lot of employees who can only speak English.
Bruce, thanks a lot for the call. So he says, stepping stone jobs for Americans who want to move on to something else, maybe being taken by immigrants, some lead jobs now Americans being bumped out of. Do we see any of that at the factory level, Steve?
I think you're seeing a little bit of both. I think the question is it the immigrants coming in and saying, I'm willing to work cheaper than an American worker, or is it the employer that is saying, I want to pay as low as I possibly can? And that's one of the way that businesses drive profitability, is they've got one of two choices to drive profitability. One is, I'm going to lower my cost as low as I possibly can, which means cheap labor. And if it's immigrants, it's immigrants. Or I'm going to try to become as innovative as I possibly can and become profitable that way. A lot of businesses in Wisconsin have taken the first approach. They want to drive their costs down as low as possible. That means cheap labor. A lot of Americans won't work for those low wages. They prefer better paying jobs.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Stephen Deller, professor of applied economics at UW-Madison, talking about immigration and the U.S. workforce and economy. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.